Thanksgiving morning. Special source to be able to give a shiur in the Beis Medrash on a day when many are preoccupied with hachanas, sudas, and all kinds of other activities. Ki heim chayenu v'orech yomenu v'ohem nega yomam v'loilam. My topic this morning is the Geirus controversy. The topic was selected because the yeshiva is learning Masechta Yevamos, and although many shiurim are learning many different prokim and many different sugyas, certainly the sugya of Geirus is a very important one that all of us should know at least something about. It affects more of us than we would think. And it is also created, as the title implies, quite a controversy in our community. I haven't heard too many people fighting about Tzoroseyan or Tzoros Tzoroseyan in recent generations. But about Geirus, it's been quite a polemic. Let's begin from the beginning. The original Geirus was Ma'amad Har Sinai. And the Gemara derives in the Sefer Krisus on the test the halacha specific halachas of Geirus from Ma'amad Har Sinai. Mila, Tevila, Korban. Today we no longer can bring a Korban. And Kabbalas HaMitzvahs. We are not going to focus today on the Mila, nor on the Tevila, certainly not on the Korban, rather on Kabbalas HaMitzvahs. It is this which has created the controversy which besets us to this very day. Kabbalas HaMitzvahs is not a particular act such as Mila and Tefillah and Korban. Those are very circumscribed, very specific actions. You all know what a meal is, and a tefillah, and a korban. Either you did it, or you didn't do it. Fine. Kabbalas HaMitzvahs, however, is an acceptance. It's not completely clear what the role of Kabbalas HaMitzvahs is in Geirus. What does that mean? For example, Tosfos Masechta Yevamos tells us that when the Gemara says, Ger Tzara Shlosha Mishpat Ksivbe, there need to be three people present at the moment of the Geirus. This has reference to the Kabbalas HaMitzvahs. As long as there were three people there during the Kabbalas HaMitzvahs, no one has to be there, not for the Mila, not for the Tefillah, certainly not for the Korban. That's it. Kabbalas HaMitzvahs is the most important, if you will, of the acts of Geirus. Geirus is three acts, Mila, Tefillah, Kabbalas HaMitzvahs. But Kabbalas HaMitzvahs is the most important act insofar as it and only it requires the Ikuva that there be three people there. So writes Tosfos. The Rambam, in the opposite corner, it's not even completely clear that Kabbalas HaMitzvahs is a sine qua non. You have to be Mekabel Mitzvahs, and otherwise the Geirus is not valid. And there's an entire school of thought within Shitas HaRambam that denies the whole thing. Because when he goes through the list of what has to be done, he has Mila, he has Tefillah, he has Korban. He doesn't have Kabbalas HaMitzvahs. There are those who claim that it's not really so necessary. The majority view is that the Rambam also requires Kabbalas HaMitzvahs, although perhaps, according to him, has a different character. It's not one of the three separable acts of Geirus, Mila, Tefillah, Kabbalas HaMitzvahs. Rather, according to the Rambam, from his phraseology, you get the impression that Kabbalas HaMitzvahs is what we'd call a prerequisite for Geirus. Where the Rambam phrases it, when a person wants to come close to Hashem, be mekabel the mitzvahs, then he goes through the process, Mila, Tevila, Korban, etc. But without Kabbalas HaMitzvahs, you can't even get to first base. You can't even begin. You can't even start. So Kabbalas HaMitzvahs, according to most, within Shitas HaRambam is absolutely critical and necessary. You can't do without it. However, it's not one of the three specific distinct acts. Rather, it is a prerequisite to the beginning of the actual Geirus process. Does it make a difference in Halacha which way it slices? Perhaps yes. Perhaps according to the Rambam, you need the Bezdin. The Bezdin's presence is required for the technical acts of Geirus, the Mila and the Tevila. Perhaps not for the Kabbalah Samitzis. It's just a prerequisite. It's just something which comes before. Okay, this is merely a potential nafkamina between these two formulations of what the nature of Kabbalah Samitzis is. But the presumption is that according to both authorities, Tosfos and the Rambam, Kabbalah Samitzis is indeed required for Geirus. Okay? This is my introduction. Any questions, feel free to raise your hand at any point and ask. I don't want to lose anybody here. So far it's clear. Okay. Good. So in fact, the Shulchan Aruch, that we usually follow the Shulchan Aruch, in fact quotes Kabbalah Smitzis as a requirement. And therefore, as one of the recent great Rabbonim wrote, it's not so critical to us whether the quote of the Rambam, you do or don't need it, because the Shulchan Aruch requires it explicitly, and that's all. Like everything else in life, what's explicit in the Shulchan Aruch, as we understand it, you can always find someone to disagree. And there is, in fact, a particular opinion which disagrees, although the Shulchan Aruch says explicitly, you have to have Kabbalah Smitzis, doesn't really mean it, it's just the Chatchila, you really have to have it, and you can live without it. That's not the simple read of the Shulchan Aruch. Fine. So therefore, there should be no controversy at all. We all agree. You don't need a Korban anymore. Okay, now we all agree. Mila Tvila, we all agree. And we agree you need Kabbalah Samitzis. So what's there to fight about? Oh, here's where the fights first begin. Just imagine an individual comes before a Bezdin and we ask him some questions. The Gemara tells us in Masechta Yevamos, Modiyano so miktas mitzvahs kalas or miktas mitzvahs chamuras. We tell the Geirus candidate some of the easier mitzvahs and some of the harder mitzvahs, and in Mikabel, if he says, I accept it, then right away we go into the Geirus process of the Mila and the Tevila, it becomes Jewish. So we see, therefore, that there is a notification process called Hodah, Modiyah Noso, which is followed by a Kabbalah process, an acceptance of the part of the prospective Geir. Good. The problems begin with the following. This is all well and good in the case of what we call in our language a Ger Tzedek, an individual who wishes to join Klal Yisrael for no ulterior motive, when we have no reason to assume that his Kabbalah Samitzis is anything less than perfectly sincere, what does he need this headache for? We tell him so explicitly. Look at the Gemara in Yevamos. Why are you joining us, Klal Yisrael, and Nidfim and Tuchufim? We have anti-Semites who want to hurt us, and what do you need all this for? No, I want it anyway. So that, he has no ulterior motive. Obviously, this person is very sincere, and when the person says, I accept all the mitzvahs, so obviously the person really means it, and the person is 100% Jewish after going through the Mila and the Tevila. Fine. The problem is, what happens if there's an ulterior motive? So this is a sugya. Everything I quoted until now is in the fourth parak of Masechta Yevamos. What I'm quoting now is in the second parak. So I guess there's a greater chance that Tamim is off of that base. We'll get there. You don't have to get to the mems. That's already an accomplishment to get to the mems, and not too many rabbis will go straight get to the mems, but the chofs, that stands a better chance. So there's a Mishnah Chof Dalad Amid Beis. The Mishnah Chof Dalad Amid Beis has reference to an individual. There were rumors of a liaison between him and a non-Jewish woman. So the Mishnah says that if the non-Jewish woman were to convert, that the man is not permitted to marry her. Rashi explains, by marrying her, he is in effect confirming those rumors of his misbehavior. Okay. In that context, the Gemara cites a dispute about Geirus for ulterior motives. According to the opinion of Rav Nechemiah, they're not valid. And a number of examples are given. One is called Geirei Arayos, famous Rav Kusim. Geirei Arayos saying they converted because they feared that lions would devour them if they wouldn't convert. And there are those who convert for the sake of kingship and power, as in the time of Malchus, the David and Shlomo, and those who convert out of fear. Rabbi me ame ha'oretz misyadim ki nofal pachad ehudim aleim, game of Mordechai and Esther. None of those three categories is very common nowadays, for reasons which are obvious. But the last one, which is this is we have to spend the rest of the shir on, so we call in our language a ger of ish l'shem isha or isha l'shem ish. Ger to the purpose of marriage. The sad fact is that statistically, the overwhelming majority of geirus in the world today is geirus l'shem ishus, for the sake of marriage. Chodesh Nechemiah, nothing to talk about. This geirus is invalid. Halacha k'divrei ha'omrim, kulam geirim heim. We paskin, and even though it was an ulterior motive, nonetheless, post facto, maybe we shouldn't have accepted them in the first place, and perhaps the Gemara seems to say, but bid the yevet after they converted, kulam geirim heim. The geirus is valid, and they're full-fledged members of the Jewish community. Okay? So we have a happy ending. What's the problem? So who cares? Someone argues. Bottom line is, kulam geirim heim. What's the problem? Oh. The problem is, let's begin by quoting the Ritva on that very daf. And the Mukha Yosef quotes it briefly. The question becomes, wait a minute. If the person is converting for an ulterior motive, how do you know that when he accepts the mitzvahs, he's doing so sincerely? Maybe he's only paying lip service to a technical requirement to accept the mitzvahs, and he's thinking only one thing, that woman, she's thinking only one thing, that man, doesn't care about Torah, doesn't care about mitzvahs, they're just saying what they're told to be, what they know has to be said in front of the bezin, and they don't mean it at all. That's a very good question. Answers the ritva as follows. The Ritva says, there's a chazaka, there's a presumption, that agav unsayu, because they are forced to accept and keep the mitzvahs, gamru v'kiblu, they had a sincere commitment to accept and in fact to practice the mitzvahs of the Torah. Adka. The simple read, this is how Reb Chaim Ozer reads it in his tshuva, is that this expression of agav unsa refers back to all the categories, including, and of course for us most prominently, geirus l'shem ishus. What is the onus? The onus is, well, he wants to marry the girl or the boy. But the obvious question is, what do you mean? As far as the technical requirements are concerned, he can simply say he accepts the mitzvahs. The Bezdin will believe what he says. He has no dream of ever keeping a single solitary mitzvah. He gets what he wants. His girlfriend, her boyfriend, and they get married. The rabbi will perform the ceremony because after all there was a conversion. How do we know there's any sincerity whatsoever in that acceptance? That's the question. What's the Ritva talking about? What do you mean, agav unsa? Because of the onus, he will undoubtedly accept upon himself to keep the mitzvahs. Maybe it's a pure bluff. Where do we find Shas? I'll ask the Talmidim. Where do we find the Shas, it's a paraphrase. When the Ritva says that Agav Unsa, because of the onus, he has no alternative, Gomar V'kibel, he accepts upon himself a commitment which he otherwise would not have accepted upon himself, as considered to be a valid commitment. Where in Shas do we find a similar phrase? Yes? Excellent. Toyu V'zavin Zvini Zvini. Mamba Basra. A person, someone holds a gun to your head and says, sell me this land or I'll kill you. He says, okay, I'm happy to sell it. He's happy to sell it. He doesn't want to sell it. He's happy to sell it. The guy could have killed him just like this. Or the guy could have taken away his field just like this. He's a gentleman, this crook. Relatively speaking, honor among thieves. He's a gentleman. He's willing to pay the full value of this field. And then he won't let me kill anybody. Okay, under the circumstances, not a bad deal. Not bad. So agav unsa gomar umakna. So the Gemara says in Baba Basra, he has no choice. He's being paid full money for it. Otherwise, he may be killed. The sale goes through. Let me ask you the following shaila. What will happen in the following case? This guy is a ganef, and he comes with a gun. He says, you know, if you don't sell me the field, I will kill you. So I sell the field. This works, we understand very well, in a case in which the guy has a gun. He is an underworld criminal. His hold on power, the power of the street, shows no signs of abating. I have no recourse to go to the court of law and get my field back from this guy, because even the government is afraid of this guy. He's an armed bandit. One of the powerful governments in the time of the Gemara. Fine, that's that case. What will happen if the bandit starts up with me, he doesn't know who I am, he asks me to settle him in the field? Fine, I settle in the field, no problem, because I know my father is the king, and my father the king can take this guy and put him away. So I'll sign the piece of paper, here's take my field, here take the next field, take 10 fields, what? The next day, then father the king will come with all this whole mighty royal army. And even though the guy is gone, but there's a whole royal army, the guy will be, one way or the other, will be put away, and I'll get my field back. Good, so that's what happens. Brings in the army, gets his field back, and the guy walks in, this underworld criminal, walks into the court and says, this field is mine. Why is the field mine? Well, I have a document signed by this gentleman. You reckon it's signed? Yes? Yes? Did you sign it? Yes? And I read in the Gemara, I read in the Talmud, that Agav Ones Gomorrah Makne. That's exactly why I did it that way. I offered the money, full value, because I wanted that field. I read the Talmud, so now it's mine. Comes the Dvar Avraham, Chelek Gimel and Simon Chav Ches, says baloney, not his at all, because this fellow, since he knew that the very next day he can call us, is calling the royal army and take the field right back from him, he never had any sincere intention to transfer ownership of the field to this armed robber. He was just playing with him. He was playing with him because he knew he had the upper hand at the end of the day. Okay, so far so good. Oh. Having said that, the Dvar Avraham proceeds to explain as follows. What does the Ritva mean? Agav unsa gomer makabel. It must be that the fellow has no alternative even after the conversion process is completed. He's come out of the mikvah. He has no alternative but to maintain the commitment that he verbalized in the mikvah, namely the observance of Torah and mitzvahs. Pray tell, where's the royal army? Where's the Kadosh Baruch Hu's army? The Kadosh Baruch Hu have troops. They're from famous people who wonder, where is troops? Starting from Pyro and all the way through to those who formulated such responses even into the 20th century. Where's troops? The answer is clear. The answer is, this person is converting for the sake of marriage. The marriage partner is a member of the Jewish community. Now please remember, it's hard for us to put ourselves back into the shoes of those who lived in Talmudic times. The Jewish community, historically, sort of the community that is loyal to the words of the Chazal and the Mishnah and the Gemara, is an observant Jewish community. An observant Jewish community means that there's certain rules and regulations which have to be kept in order to be accepted into the community. And presuming the fact that the potential marriage partner was born Jewish, belongs to that community, he or she will insist on meticulous observance of these rules and regulations. Otherwise, the deal's going to fall apart. So this fellow knows he meets a Jewish woman, or she meets a Jewish man, and a Jewish man or woman in those days meant an observant Jewish woman or Jewish man. So you know what? If I want, I fell in love with this particular man or woman, I'll have no choice but to adopt her lifestyle. Otherwise, it's not going to go. It's not going to work. So therefore, you know, I never heard of Shabbos before, I never heard of Kashrus before, Taras Mishpacha, just imagine that. But it's not going to work otherwise, because the prospective marriage partner is someone who observes these laws and is very passionate about them. So I'm going to have to just, you know, do the same thing, otherwise it's not going to work. That is the onus. That is an onus which is more powerful than a royal army, as the Berdicheva said famously, when he asked around on Pesach for some chametz, no one could give him any, and he asked for some contraband, and no Rebbe, we got across the border under the nose of the police and the army. We have some for you, have some good stuff for you. So the Berdicheva looks to show, the Rebbein Hishalayla, the Lord, the Tsar, has thousands upon thousands of troops, and yet Achena B'nai Yisrael can. You have no sentries, you have no guards, you have nobody. All you have is the Torah Kedosha and the loyalty of your Achena B'nai Yisrael to the Torah, and there's not a morsel of chametz to be had. More powerful than the royal troops. So too over here, the Jewish marriage partner's commitment to Torah is stronger than the police and the army. So if you want to belong to that individual and that community, you can have no alternative. Atkan, the analysis of the Dvar Avraham based upon the words of the Ritva. Any questions? Now we come to the punchline. The punchline is, says the Dvar Avraham, who was writing this in a response to Rav Chaim Oizer. This is presumably written in the 1930s. That's who we fooling. This was true in the olden days, when an individual who wanted to be Jewish had no alternative but to acclimate to the ways of the observant society. There was no other Jewish society, and to acclimate to the ways of the Jewish marriage partner, whose ways were ways of Torah. There were no other ways in those days. Today, who are we kidding? In the overwhelming majority of the cases, the prospective marriage partner who's born Jewish is him or herself not observant. That's why they fell in with this non-Jewish individual. So now what's going to happen? You're going to join the Jewish people. You say, yes, I accept, I accept, I accept, I accept, I accept. Wink, wink. The next day, you'll tell the Jewish marriage partner, we're really going to keep Shabbos. We're really going to keep Kashrus. You never kept Shabbos and Kashrus, but you want to keep it now? No. Okay. We'll say, but you have to belong to a Jewish community. Why? You can be, quote, unaffiliated. You can, in the old days, and even in recent in Europe, we'll say pre-French Revolution, even in parts even thereafter, you had to belong to a community. You had to be a Jew or to be a Christian. There was no alternative. So and you had to be a Jew, you were subservient to the Jewish community, which was the stronghold of the Orthodox leadership. There was no other way out. Today, it's a Wild West. It's only in our part of the world. You can convert. You never have to go into shul for the rest of your life. You never have to eat kosher. You never have to keep Shabbos. Nothing. So obviously, you didn't mean anything. So therefore, in the typical case of Geirus and Shemishus claims the Dvar Avraham, since its effectiveness was based on a chazakah of Agav Unas Gomer Mekabel, that chazakah has ceased to exist. And therefore, the fact that the individual paid lip service to the Beis Din and said, I accept Shabbos, I accept Kashrus, I accept Taras and Mishpacha, etc., etc., is meaningless. And therefore, we assume that the typical case of Geirus and Shemishus, which is comprised of the vast majority of Geirus today, is invalid. Atkan. That's a mouthful. That's true. Then there are thousands upon thousands of individuals walking around in the world considering themselves Jewish because either they converted or their mother converted or their mother's mother converted, but they're not Jewish. Scary. Very scary. So I said Barbara. At the end, he has some words which may soften his particular stance. It's hard to know exactly what he means in this last paragraph, but that's the upshot of his analysis. Now, as I said before, we in America, we're, as I said, the Wild West, or as some call it, it's a national holiday, the land of the free and the home of the brave. People do whatever they want. So, you know, anyone can perform a marriage ceremony, no problem. It's only when it comes to a more meticulous officiant who wants to know that the person is 100% Jewish, that things start to get a little bit dicey. Because there are many, as I said before, many, many people who themselves or their mother's mothers converted over the last, let's take the last, all those years. Probably wrote in the 1930s. So 1930s till today, we're talking about 80 years. A lot of opportunity for three generations of conversions. Right? What if the grandmother converted in the 40s and we have it clear that there's no denying she converted, they were not observant. They didn't keep Shabbos. They didn't keep Kashrus. They didn't keep Taras HaMishpach. They'll tell you. That the person might still be alive who converted in those times. So there's a tradition that everybody knows. I'm not hiding the fact, but honest people. They may have been converted by an Orthodox rabbi, but the truth is, in that Orthodox rabbi's shul, likely many of the members themselves drove to shul on Shabbos. Everyone knows of these. In some small pockets, it's true to this day. Orthodox shuls with open parking lots that even exist, yes, famous shuls. I'm not here to say to comment upon them. It's a reality. So there were many people who belonged to Orthodox communities, and they were drove even to shul on Shabbos, and then they drove maybe to the mall or to the football game or Thanksgiving, it's a big football day, so maybe it was to one in Yonah the Yoma. But this is the only kosher one. It's not on Saturday, it's on Thursday. This is okay. But you have to go to the bowl games or whatever games. That's Saturday. There's a national collegiate football. It's a whole zach. So, and then there's the mall. The malls are busy on Saturday also. And then there's the kashrus. What kind of do they keep kosher? Even if they had some kind of standards in the house, they keep kosher out of the home. All those who know history know, and it's even in the present state. There's some who have that kind of taras of a shpach or what? It was forlorn and forsaken, almost forgotten. So therefore, according to this analysis, there's a big problem with such individuals. But the problem is easily solved if the individual who wants to get married right now, Tov Shinai and Beis, is observant. Because it's very easy to take a dip in a mikvah. So an individual who is him or herself, or his or her mother, or his or her mother's mother, was the subject of a questionable conversion, can solve the problem in a few minutes by going into a mikvah in the presence of three rabbanim and accepting the mitzvahs all over again. Fine. We call that a gir l'chumrah. That's the term of art that's to be used for those who had previous geiris that we're not fully comfortable with. We call it a gir l'chumrah. Of course, it's a sliding scale. Is it 90-10? Is it 10-90? We're not going into the details of every particular case. That's great. But what will happen? The person right now is still not observant. So what do you gain? Should pay lip service a second time. They already did it themselves 10 years ago, or their mother 35 years ago, or the grandmother 60 years ago. It already happened, this lip service. Or any better than the previous one. This is a major problem which every Rav faces. When I do a Siddur Kiddushin, I ask the couple, the husband and the prospective husband and wife, are there any adoptions or conversions in your family as far back as you know? Why do I include the word adoptions? Because these days, many if not most adoptions are from non-Jewish parents. It's hard to find a Jewish child these days. There's so much contraception, abortion, as the case may be. Not like it used to be. That's just the reality. And if those conversions are not up to par, it's a problem. And perhaps has to be repeated. Now, my clientele in Siddur Kiddushin are from a yidden, from men and women. So if it's a problem, it's easily solved. But many rabbis in the field, their clientele is largely non-observant. They don't have such an easy solution. A word about... Yeah, what's the question?
For Gir L'Chumrah, what would that be? How would that, get Kohanim and Yehudis?
That's a big problem. A Kohen may not marry a Gioris. And the question will be, what if you have a perfectly observant lady whose mother underwent a conversion, an Orthodox conversion, 30-something years ago, but never kept Shabbos at that time? Even if 10 years later she decided to keep Shabbos, doesn't matter, it's too late. Too late on two counts. Number one, presumably it has to be another tefillah. Number two, she already had this current prospective kala, was already born. Now what do you do? So the sad fact is you have to paskin and she may not marry a Kohen. Sad fact, but that's the reality. Because to marry a Kohen, you have to be fairly certain that this woman was the mother had converted properly originally, which if we're not certain, she should be advised not to meet any Kohanim. Okay? Now, a word about Ger Katan. This Gemara Ger Katan, truthfully, is not found in Masechta Yevamah, it's found in Masechta Psubis. However, the Rif quotes in Masechta Yevamah, so we can talk about that too, briefly. Gemara says, Ger Katan, not Bilan, also Al Das Bezdin. Why? Who knows why? Four words. Zach Ala Adam, Shalom Afanim. It's good to be Jewish. A major dispute rages to this very day. What do you mean it's good to be Jewish? If you're being brought up in a from home, of course it's good to be Jewish. So many mitzvahs, right? If you're from, so there'll be ever the some averis, but obviously the mitzvahs will overwhelm the small number of averis. As with every person who's born Jewish, born from FFB, you have to hope, you have to respond, that our mitzvahs outweigh our averis. Yeah, we hope so. But what happens if the child is going to be brought up in a non-from home? Non-from parents want to adopt a child. They have no children of their own. Now what are you going to do? So they're going to be brought up in a house where the Shabbos is not kept, the kashrus is not kept, so they won't keep Shabbos, they won't keep kashrus. So what kind of schus is that? Why is it good? Isn't it better to be an observant non-Jew than a sinful Jew? What do you say? What? True, they don't know better, but the bottom line still is that they are sinful Jews instead of observant non-Jews. So the answer to my question is not clear. Many, many Gedolei HaPoskim say it's certainly not good to be a sinful Jew. Better remain an observant non-Jew. But there's a significant opinion, body of opinion, which says the other way around. Better to be, there's a quote from Rav Moshe, Merish'ei Yisrael, from the sinners of Israel. In part because the sins don't count so much, because you're a bit of a tinek shenishba, and the mitzvahs do count, and after all, kol Yisrael yesh lam chelek olam haba, and therefore, maybe it is good, and therefore maybe it is a schus, perhaps. There's a caveat, even if that's true, it's already one suffix. Is it considered a schus, in which case the geres is valid, or is it considered a chom, in which case the geres is invalid? That's suffix number one. Suffix number two. The Gemara says in the Sefta Ksubis, or the Rif omits it, the question is why, Higdilu Yecholim Limchos. When they turn 12 or 13, they can protest their Jewishness. And as Rashi explains, they protest their Jewishness, they're not Jewish. On a simple level, they were never Jewish, retroactively, as the Agos Oshri says. Others say, somewhat inexplicably, that they were Jewish, then they become not Jewish. It's hard to explain that exactly, but that's what they say. But in any event, they're no longer Jewish. Now the question becomes, what will happen if at age 12 and 13, this young child who was converted as an infant continues along the ways of his father, adopted father and mother, continue to go to drive on Shabbos, continue to eat non-kosher food? Is that in and of itself the equivalent of a machah? He protested the Torah way of life. Not only he didn't put on a big banner and go protest in downtown Manhattan, but instead, he just went and he ate treif and he was Michal Shabbos. Perhaps that itself was a protest. This too is a matter of significant dispute. So we have now a bit of a svekzveka. Is this individual who was converted upon adoption to a non-observant home and continues to be non-observant when he turns 12 or 13, now that he's 20, wants to marry a person who's born Jewish, is this conversion valid or not? We don't know. If the person, again, it's from now, no problem. The Wagir Lechumra. The person's not from now, the same problem exists. It's just a brief description of Ger Katan. There was an interesting policy that a certain rabbinical organization had. If the adoptive parents who are not from, promise, commit to send their young child to a Jewish, Orthodox Jewish school through 12th grade, then they assume it's a schus. Because absolutely, there's such a good chance that this child will grow observant after all 12 years of intensive school in a Jewish day school and high school. So therefore, since it's probably going to become observant, so therefore it's a schus. The sad statistics, sad, I say it's very sad, are, to the best of my knowledge, if you take all the individuals who went to Orthodox day schools and high schools, who come from non-observant homes, and there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of them, and do a survey. All right, 5 years later, if they got finish high school at 18, give them 5 years. Give a person 5 years to find themselves. Give them 5 years. They're now 23. The sad fact, to the best of my knowledge, is that the significant majority, unfortunately, are not observant. If you find that I'm wrong, please notify me immediately. That can have a significant impact on the halacha. So therefore, that same organization now does not want to accept these individuals because of this fact. It might be a chova. We're not saying for sure that they're not Jewish after the fact, but there's a suffix, it's a doubt. We don't want to get involved in doubtful cases. So therefore, the standards today require that the parents be observant, which means that they walk the shul on Shabbos and belong to a Jewish community, and they keep kosher. Then the children can be converted, but not before. Of course, the question becomes, and this is all over the press, how can this be that an organization can change its policy in midstream and leave thousands of people holding the bag? After all, they're sincere. They didn't tithe who they were. They were honest to the rabbis. They were not observant right now. We'll send our kids to a school. They sent the kids to the school. The kid was not observant. And now you're saying to this person that he's not Jewish, even though an Orthodox rabbi converted him according to the standards which existed then in his rabbinical organization. It's not fair. Answer, correct. It's not fair. But that's not the question. The question is the person Jewish or not? That's the question. So, there were those who maintained, as long as at the time that the conversion was done, the policy of that particular branch of the rabbinate was, it's considered to be a schus, it's good to have this kind of a conversion, so that convert should remain Jewish, even if now the standards have changed. I don't think that's correct. It is true that there's certain actions which are done at a particular time in a particular way, and they're considered to be valid, notwithstanding the fact that a later Bezdin came along and ruled differently. Yeah, a korban was supposed to be brought in a certain way. And then the Bezdin came along and said that it should be done a different way. Or someone, all these kinds of things. What's done is done is done. Well, that's the following shaila. Imagine you have a Bezdin HaGadol of 71 people. They're the ones that final decisions of all complex matters. And they rule that a certain thing is kosher. Good, it's kosher. There's a vacancy, someone is nifter, and there is a replacement. And now he's a swing vote. Now they rule 36-35 that it's treif. I still have in my locker a refrigerator, there was a pickled tongue from the which was then ruled kosher, and now it's ruled treif. May I eat that meat now? Yes. Sir. Who votes yes? Who votes no? You're right. The answer is no. What do you mean? But I bought in the butcher store and it had a whatever. OBDG, Bezdin Gadol, right? They're Ashkocha. And I bought it, I paid money for it, and it says, what do you mean I can't eat it? The answer is, there's a new BDG. And the new BDG says that it's not kosher, and you have to follow the BDG of today. But it's not fair. Correct. But it's also not kosher. So that's the paradigm that I would like to suggest, even though I understand here we're talking about living human beings, levadic afflation, not talking about a pickled tongue. But and it's very sad. We deal with what they call personal status, very sensitive issues. But nonetheless, we have to follow the halacha as we see it. So that's here in the United States of America where this issue comes up. There's been a call by a group of rabbis to relax the standards of conversion. It's not fair that there's so much centralization. And the centralization comes about as a result of a particular one man. This one man was a Yirat Tzadik, a Talmud Chochem, a Yirei Shamayim. Because of this one man, this whole brouhaha has erupted. The name of the man is Arav HaGoyin, from Shlomo Amar Shalita, Rishon Litzion, Rav HaRashil Yisrael. Who has ever met him? He was saying, who ever met him? Who heard him in our yeshiva? Who have you met? Tzadik, Talmud Chochem, Yirei Shamayim. Alamayus. as part of the Israeli rabbinical system, he's a big believer in centralization. That's the whole Rabbanut HaRashit is based upon the principle of centralization. And when he came to the issue of Geirus, he was confounded when he heard that the Geirim in America will come to Eretz Yisrael, and how do you find out if the Geirus is valid or not? On an ad hoc basis. So it's gone on for years. You know, there'd be someone who worked in a particular office of the Betin Rabbani. He'd call a well-placed individual here in this country and get information, and he'd act based upon information. No! Going forward, we have to have a centralized system, which of course we have to approve. Okay? Once a man makes such a decision, so now you have to protect your clientele. Going forward, a person who was converted by a private citizen will have a harder time being recognized in the state of Israel, even as some of those who converted before at a centralized system have somewhat of a hard time. But but for those who chose an individual system after the rabbi called for a centralized system, they'll have even a harder time. So, part of a haftim as a ger is to help someone who converts. So a system was set up, a centralized system. This raised the ire of individuals who said, this is ridiculous. We want to be able to work as a solo operator, as individual practitioners. The answer, of course, is, of course you can. Be my guest. But then, they can want to go to Eretz Yisrael, they're going to have a problem. But it's not fair. Not in this world, not fair. Maybe the next chief rabbi will reverse it. I don't know what's going to be. But right now, this is the policy of the state of Israel rabbinate, and you want to help protect individuals who want to be lachsos tachas kafei yashchina. So a system was set up, and you may even see as Talmidim in our yeshiva in this very building, there are meetings which are held upstairs with prospective converts, and there's a rigorous system. And aside from checks and balances, which the system has, because you see, an individual rabbi can be subjected to pressures. Right? The shul president says, my son came home with a non-Jewish woman from college, you must convert him. So the bottom line is there's already a foregone conclusion, but what he says, she said, we know the bottom line has to be, he has to keep his job. So that's the kind of pressures, and some more subtle, that rabbis faced over the years, and therefore having a centralized system where the rabbis are not subjected to the same pressures could yield a better result. So part of the system is what we call in our language follow-up. So this system has been in place for about 4 years now approximately, and there is annual follow-up. I'm pleased to report to you that according to my latest statistics, the success rate of this Besdin system hovers at approximately 90%, which is, for those who know the world, it's a mind-bogglingly successful statistic. Halavai, we should continue and even improve on that statistic. There's so much flash in the pan geirus today, even among sincere converts at the time. You know, you experiment with this, experiment with that. But Baruch Hashem, we try to have those individuals ferreted out from the system. We take people who are stable. We often question the stability. We use psychological tests, which were developed in California by this very distinguished psychologist working for the Besdin out there. We try. No one is perfect. We all make mistakes. This is the situation here in America. So once again, this system has come up recently. There are still individuals who are practicing on their own. Fine. They'll have a harder time recognition in the state of Israel. And frankly, even in America, because people say, well, who did it? So where people perhaps didn't raise their eyebrows, which they should have, 5 years ago, now they do. Because it's a central system. Why didn't you use a central system? One implication is that it wasn't up to the standard of the central system. So already for those who are medakting and b'mitzvahs, they'll think twice. Okay. But what happens here is, how should I say it? The controversy in this country is really nothing if you compare it to what's going on in the Holy Land. The Holy Land, things are a little bit more intense in general. Those who've been there know what I speak. So there you have a major crisis, because marriages are only sanctioned by the state-sponsored rabbinate. They may give their sanction to other batei din if they so desire, but it has to be approved by the chief rabbi. That is their bailiwick, that's their turf, that's their responsibility, and that's their domain. Now you have put that together with the fact that hundreds of thousands, I repeat, hundreds of thousands of non-Jews emigrated to Eretz Yisrael from the former Soviet Union. When I was a young man, there were protests in the streets, save Soviet Jewry, and we went here, we went there, and all kinds of things. So Baruch Hashem, the Kodesh Baruch was Rachman, the gates opened and the Iron Curtain fell, but not until more than 70 years of absolute repression of religion by the communists, Yimach Shema, so that the individuals were coming out, they were generally atheists. It wasn't their fault, but literally, but that's what it was. And it was intermarriage was rampant, so that of the, I don't know the exact numbers of how many people came from those countries, so many, but of those so many, there are hundreds of thousands who are not Jewish. What are you doing then? They're integrating into all aspects of Israeli society, they're serving in the army, they're meeting Jewish men and women. Now what do you do? So, I have an ideal solution. Make them observant, and we can do a conversion. It's an ideal solution. But like many ideal solutions, they just don't work in real life. And again, their best efforts are being made, but it just doesn't work. As a matter of fact, many of these don't even want to convert. Their honesty doesn't let them do it. It's a bluff. What kind of bluff? I'm not going to accept it. You want to go to a mikveh? Happy to do it. Even a milah, which is not easy for an adult. Okay, that we can handle. But you're asking me to accept Shabbos and Kashrus? What's that? It's not my lifestyle. Nor is the lifestyle of the boyfriend or girlfriend I met in the army or I met whoever I met, Tel Aviv. So why am I going to? It's ridiculous. So they refuse to convert. They can't be married. So there are all kinds of problems. They're living without marriage. They're getting married civilly elsewhere. Well, all kinds of solutions. But the official governmental solution is conversion. The problem is they're not for... The ingenious Jewish mind created a system of what they call batei din legiur. Special Betin Miyuchad Legiur. They specialize in conversion. And it has a branch in the army, in Tzal, and many of them serve. Problem is that these conversions, generally speaking, create non-observant converts. So the assumption is that what they accept, as they're taught, to keep the mitzvahs, they just say it, but they don't really mean it. And we know that they don't mean it because thousands before them and thousands after them say exactly the same thing, and the follow-up there indicates opposite results, literally opposite results. Likely that 90% are non-observant. The only statistical survey that could be done, because these are very defy statistics, there's no follow-up system. Only one follow-up system when these unfortunates come once again into the hands of the chief rabbinate. How so?
Divorce.
So who cares divorce? Divorce, what's the difference if the person is from or not from? There is a difference. The Torah's Gittin says, when you write the name of a convert, write Ben or Bas, Avraham Avinu. That's right. Read it in the Parsha, right? Avraham Avinu. Every ger is a Ben or Bas, Avraham Avinu. Torah's Gittin says, the person's not from, come on. That's not fair to Avraham Avinu. So you write Hager. Hager, right? Hager. Now we have some statistics. Go through all the Gittin are computerized in Eretz Yisrael and see how many times it says Ben Avraham Avinu, how many times it says Hager. And this is being done by rabbis who have no axe to grind. It's irrelevant to them. They're just practitioners who are writing Gittin. They ask, are you from? They say yes, they write Avraham Avinu. They say no, they write Hager. They're not going to make inquisitions. Statistics show. Now remember, it's not necessarily a random sample. It could be that those who get divorced, on balance, are a little bit less, small percentage than those who don't get divorced. I can hear it, but I don't see it's such a dramatic change. 97.2% said Hager. 2.8 Ben or Bas Avraham Avinu. This leads to a conclusion that there's an umdana demuchach, that the person who comes in front of you and says, I accept the mitzvah, doesn't mean it. Why should he or she mean it? The marriage partner doesn't keep it. So they put him through school, and they have to meet him from family, they conduct themselves sincerely in their presence. But it's a bluff. There are articles in the papers that they say it's a bluff, and people feel uncomfortable about it. But you know, the Israeli press is very dogged, and they have interviews from all these people. It's all we try to find favoritism of the teachers and the families. But come on, who are we kidding? It's just a show, a charade. Therefore, many, many poskim say that this geirus is null and void. There's still a minority view which says, what do you mean? Dvarim shebolei v'enim dvarim. He said he accepts it. He accepted it. To this, the Dvar Avraham responded with a phrase which I think goes back to the Ritva. It's found in the poskim. It's Dvarim shebolivo v'leiv kol adam. And that's something which is hidden deep into the recesses of his heart. It's obvious to anyone who sees the situation what he's really thinking. It's obvious. And therefore, we cannot discount what he's thinking. We have to take into account, based upon the circumstances, as to what's happened. There was a minority view in the Rabbanut, a very, very distinguished Dayan, someone whom I know yet from my days in Keren B'Yavne 45 years ago, who was then a Rebbe, again, went on to serve as a very respected and senior Dayan, who wrote as follows. Whoever's been at a geirus knows how an emotional moment it is for everybody around. Has anyone in this room ever been in a geirus? Nobody. That's right. Yeah. Well, so now you can confirm what I'm saying. It's an emotional moment, and for no one else is emotional as the prospective convert, him or herself. So perhaps we can postulate that, notwithstanding the uninterrupted pattern of non-observant behavior from birth, from cradle to grave, but at that moment, at that split second, as the convert dunked under the water, then with the emotion of the moment, they accepted sincerely the commitment to keep the mitzvahs. Thanksgiving, they serve pie, right? Pie? This is pie in the sky. Yeah, it's me. That's what I think. I think it's pie in the sky. And another distinguished rabbi wrote very strongly against this decision. This rabbi is someone I also know personally, a very, very chashuv Talmud Chacham, who actually spent some time in our yeshiva. He was on a sabbatical from his position in the Beit Din Rabbani in Eretz Yisrael. This goes back 15, 20 years ago. He said, Shiurim, he spent the Shabbos in my house. I mean, he's a very wonderful person. He said, that's ridiculous. How can you pluck 1 second in time out of a pattern of a whole lifetime? And with that split second, they accepted it. It's just not credible. This wonderful rabbi, who, as I said, who I respect greatly, I believe, however, went a little bit over the top. Let me explain myself. I have another 3 minutes to explain why I think he went over the top. In reviewing this is what's called Beit Din HaGadol, they review the lower court decisions, he recounted that a particular lower court viewed not only the Gerim as invalid, but the Dayanim as invalid. And the strong words were thrown around, Rishoyim, not the Gerim, the Dayanim. Rishoyim, Bali Aveira, Tosel to Bidan. What's the difference? I mean, why must you call them names? The Gerim is no good anyway. The answer is, even if by a quirk, a person, the 2.8%, assuming they were firm from that moment, their Gerim is also no good. Because there was no bezin. Now, of course, the question becomes, why are they puzzled? Well, what's wrong? So what's written over there is that they are doing geirus, which is no good, and therefore they machshel people to marry these men and women against halacha. And even if they're right, the divrayim, that the geirus is good, they machshel the geirim in zillions of averus. 606 mitzvahs they take on themselves, and in a whole lifetime just multiply. Shabbos, Kashrus, Taras Mitzvah, just keep multiplying, and they're the ones who are the causes of these Averis. Lifnis and Mikshel. So I believe this is wrong on many counts. Number one, That's your opinion. But they have a different opinion. And they think they're doing a good thing. So this rabbi writes, it's true. Moshe Sanhedrin says that a person who's an undertaker, who buries the dead on Yom Tov Rishu, which is Issa Gomer, but he thinks it's a mitzvah, he confuses it with Yom Tov Sheni, confuses it with Goyim, he's not posoliatus, because he doesn't know. Over here, the rabbi writes, the reason why he's posel is because his mistake is a mistake in Dayanus. He doesn't understand that you have no right to go against the psak of all Gedolei Hador. And he proceeds to reproduce a statement written 3 years ago by 17 Gedolei Rabbonim who say, without Kabbalah's mitzvahs, the Geirus is no Geirus. And since this person has the temerity to go against the psak of Gedolei Hador, he's a Russia, and it's the Marshall people, and it's a total disaster. Shalosh Chuvas Bedov. This I'll end. Number one, they're not all the Gedolei Hador. There could be other Gedolei who didn't sign. He cites Rabbi Chanan in Kovet Shurim and Kudrus Nivrei Sofim Simon Beis, where Rabbi Chanan writes that the gathering of all of Klal Yisrael, of all Chachmei Yisrael, has the status of Bez Nagol, BDG. And he quotes the Rambam, who says that. But the Rambam says that it only existed in the time of the Gemara. And the reason why no ruling since the time of Ravina Ravashi is binding on all of Klal Yisrael is precisely because they've never gotten together with all Chachmei Yisrael. Never. So the fact that 17 rabbis signed, I bet that even they didn't get together. They just passed it around. And there are others who didn't sign, who comprise the majority of Chachmei Yisrael. Number two, all the statement says is that Geirus without Kabbalah Smithers is no good. The rabbis who disagree are willing to sign their names to that too. But they say it is a Kabbalah Smithers, because he said he's Mekabel. Number three, if you look carefully in the writings of Shuvas Beis Yitzchak, he talks about the issue. He's the one that those who say it only Kabbalah Smithers blame it on him. He's the one who articulated and formulated the idea of Kabbalah Smithers. In the case of a Ger Cotton who's coming to a non from home, he says, you know what? Even though it's a michshol that they're going to be not from, it's still better to be Jewish and to be a sinful Jew than a righteous non Jew. And Rabbi Yoshev Shlita, in his forum, says that this is a plausible position. He's not saying it's right or wrong, but it's plausible. So you see clearly that there's no lifnei evil or sita in michshol, because it's fakeret. It's better that they're Jewish even if they're not observant for them than if they're going to be not Jewish. The rabbi tries to parse the difference between a gadol and a katan. I don't quite see how that really works. So we leave it at that. The geirus is certainly very highly problematic, but the dayanim akshei umot. We'll stop here.